from KALW News in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Mateo.
San Francisco. Mission Dolores Park.
Financial District near the Tenderloin.
San Bruno.
North Sunnyvale.
Downtown Palo Alto. My beloved.
Redwood City.
Coming up, it's not a parking space. It's not a park. It's a parklet. And you've probably seen one or two around.
In a city like San Francisco, where street life is really important and really healthy, it actually makes a lot more sense to look at how some of that street can be given over to human bodies.
Also, what is the true cost of using Facebook?
What we need to do is give people a choice to have some alternative and still be able to communicate with the people on Facebook.
And a couple talks about how they met, though they lived an ocean apart.
I had watched Reservoir Dogs and I go, wow, this girl's cool.
That's today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. Over the past few years, our state has seen a huge drop in public funding for public space. Over the past year, a quarter of state parks have closed indefinitely because the state doesn't have the money to maintain them. In their place are more and more spaces that are open to public use, but privately owned. This is actually nothing new. We sometimes don't realize it, but we move into public-private spaces all the time. Places like cafes or shopping malls, or even some parks like Zuccotti in Manhattan, the starting place of the Occupy Wall Street movement.
We are the 99%!
In the Bay Area, another kind of private public space is starting to pop up. Parklets might not be as dramatic as Occupy Wall Street, but they're changing the Bay Area streetscape. Parklets are small parking space-sized places for people to come, sit, and go at their leisure with no need to buy anything. That said, parklets almost always owe their existence to a nearby business. The sponsor provides the capital, design, and stewardship of the place according to a few rules set by the San Francisco Planning Department, but the space itself is all public. Right now, there are 27 parklets on the ground in San Francisco, with more on the way. KALW's Katie Steyer visited a few of them and brings us this story.
I'm in San Francisco at the intersection of Stockton, Green, and Columbus. It's super busy, and there are tons and tons of cars going to and fro. Taxi cabs, sightseeing buses, delivery vans, motorcycles buzz past. I'm watching all of this from what used to be two or three parking spaces. Now it's a park. More specifically, a parklet. It all started back in 2005. With an idea hatched by Blaine Merker and his colleagues at San Francisco's Rebar Art and Design Studio.
We found a metered parking space in downtown San Francisco that was sunny between the hours of 12 and 2 p.m.
The idea was to reclaim space from the automobile. They called it Parking Day.
And we used that parking space as sort of the cheapest real estate in San Francisco that we could find to try and create a new kind of public space out of a niche in the urban landscape. And that project, completely as a surprise to us, sort of blossomed.
It blossomed into something of a movement. It started with one parking space in downtown San Francisco that stood for only a few hours in the afternoon, but then its popularity skyrocketed. Parking Day is now held in cities on every continent except Antarctica. But that's just one day. Merker wanted to make it into something more permanent.
In a city like San Francisco, where street life is really important and really healthy, it actually makes a lot more sense to look at how some of that street can be given over to human bodies.
Thus, the parklet. To build a parklet, a sponsor, usually a business owner, but sometimes a neighborhood resident, pitches the planning department. Next comes the permit, which can cost as much as $15,000. That may sound like a lot, but when you compare it to the $13.2 million currently being spent to renovate Dolores Park, it starts to seem like a deal.
My name is Olivia Ongpin, and I'm from San Francisco, California.
Olivia Ongpin co-owns an art gallery in the Mission. Out front, they've built a parklet that's an extension of the gallery. The parklet itself is a rotating one-year exhibit. Each year, the parklet is reinvented. Local artists submit their parklet designs, and a jury of neighbors chooses the winner. Right now, the parklet holds beanbag chairs and bright green AstroTurf. Ongpin says it provides much-needed play space for young families in the area.
In the time that we've been here, we've actually seen the nature of the block change. It's been really fun to see all of the neighbors and the neighbors' kids interact and meet each other and basically sort of utilize the space as a real park, yeah, for the kids, for sure.
The program's only a couple years old, and there's been a huge amount of demand for it, and a lot of, we have a lot of applications.
Paul Chasson works at San Francisco's Pavement to Parks program. He says a quarter of San Francisco is publicly owned land.
And the vast majority of that is used for storing cars, you know, and that's space that we all, that as San Franciscans, that we own. There's just parts of the city that where people live in apartments, they don't have backyards, they don't have private open spaces, you know, or the city just doesn't, there's areas in the city where we don't have as much park space as we'd like to have. And so parklets can sort of serve some of those functions.
But parklets can also cause problems. One of the first to be built in San Francisco was in front of the Mission's Revolution Cafe. The space was so comfortable that people started to move in. Local merchants complained, and Rebar's Blaine Merker and his team decided to redesign.
The thing we learned from that is that maybe we didn't need quite as much seating, actually. And maybe the most important thing is to kind of have a kind of stand-up, you know, lean on the high table and kind of have a snack and chat with some friends and move on. But it didn't need to be sort of a living room in that space.
San Francisco resident and activist Rob Anderson says in a city where parking is at a premium, taking away scarce parking spots is another problem.
So when you take away parking, you make it more difficult for both residents in a particular area and businesses.
But it's not just about making life more difficult for drivers, says Anderson. There's a lot of money at stake.
The city owns a lot of parking garages and parking lots and the parking meters and their parking tickets. So it's a major source of revenue for a city that's, you know, having a hard time balancing its budget. And they seem to, they're developing a predator and prey relationship to everybody who has to drive in San Francisco.
But San Francisco's parking challenges aren't stopping new parklets from being built. Right now, 3 are under construction and 24 are in the design phase. In Oakland, construction on 7 temporary parklets begins in early summer. Parklets are catching on outside the Bay, too, in cities like Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and Roanoke, Virginia. Rebar Design's Blaine Merker recently advised a city in Denmark about how to institute their own parklet program. In San Francisco, I'm Katie Steyer for Cross Currents.
We'd like to hear what you think about the idea of private funding for public spaces. Also, have you been noticing these parklets and using them? Call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Public spaces are funded by your tax dollars. Speaking of which, it's tax day, and if you don't have your stuff together by now, don't fret. You have a little less than 6.5 hours left till deadline. And thanks to the internet, you don't have to leave your snug bed tonight to meet that deadline. According to the IRS, 99 million people, that's 70% of taxpayers, filed their taxes online last year rather than going to their friendly neighborhood tax preparer. In some ways, the internet is an open, unlimited space, but it can also feel very private, especially when communicating one-on-one or conducting personal business, like paying a bill or doing your taxes. As more and more of our daily lives go digital, some big questions arise, like, what are we giving up? What truly is the cost of our being so dependent on it? And who's truly benefiting from how much we're glued to our screens? Author Jason Ben-Levy explores this question in his book, Too Much Magic. He spoke with KALW's Ben Treffney.
a lot of money is spent to try to attract people to these ad-driven services, whether it's Facebook or whether it's Google. So obviously, there's a lot of profit to be made within these industries that are using us consumers as products. How do you see that use of brain power and financial resourcing?
Yeah, I when I look at the level of innovation that happened in the early 90s toward computing, and how we were inventing entirely new categories of applications and uses, and that we, you know, put multimedia on computers, and that, you know, our biggest invention of the last decade has really just been social networking, which is really not that complicated a technology. It's actually pretty lightweight stuff. And even the implementations we're seeing are pretty ugly and not well conceived. Facebook is probably the only application that people regularly hate. And
there's not a function on Facebook for hate.
No, there's not a function for hate, except that usually whenever they roll out a change, it doesn't make sense to people. It usually doesn't work very well. Certainly Timeline may be one of the ugliest graphical approaches I've ever seen. And when you compare that to the effort that it took when the Macintosh was being invented, as an example, to make it simple for people, to make it elegant, to make it beautiful, to make it something that people wanted to engage with because it was all of those things, because it was artful, and then compare that to what Facebook looks like, you can see that the talent is not being well spent, whether artistically or on programming, to really go and create something magnificent.
So aside from just the individual cost that one pays then for being part of these commercial enterprises, there's a larger social cost, you're saying?
Yeah, I think there's a larger social cost in a lot of different ways. I think that we've created, well, certainly with Facebook, we've created this dependency on one resource. You should be able to pick what your social application looks like to you, just like you get to pick what email client you're using or what web browser you like to use. There should be a common network behind all of social networking. So you can pick what the front looks like to you. You can pick something non-commercial. Like as an example, Mozilla, the Mozilla browser, Firefox browser allows you, you know, it's totally free. You know, it is done by a nonprofit. A lot of smart people who've cleverly come up with this so you don't have to go and be tied to any one platform. It works with everything. The servers on the back end, the stuff that's delivering you the web content, is very often Apache, which is an open source application. And so we have this whole ecosystem that already has been established that you don't have to go through any vendor in order to have a lot of functionality. I think that that's a much better model for us to move to. And then we lose the... If people decide that they want to be sifted through by Facebook and have stuff marketed toward them, that's their choice. But what we need to do is give people a choice to have some alternative and still be able to communicate with the people on Facebook. And I think that's where we really have the work to be done.
That's Jason Ben-Levy, author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech, Secrets They Won't Tell You About Your Digital Life. So how do you imagine a social networking platform like, you know, the MySpace or Facebook or something like that would look as an open source? How would it be different?
Okay. I think what would be different is kind of the business model. That is that instead of it all being on Facebook servers and Facebook decides today what the look is or whatever, that whatever you use as an ISP or your phone company or whatever or your cable company, you'd maybe pay 50 cents a month or something like that, some nominal fee that's buried in your billing, that would allow them to set up just a root service for you to go and do social networking. On top of that, you would use your normal browser, but you'd be able to pick what you'd have as kind of an interface to that. It could be set up by any number of companies, just like an app, very much like the app space, which use a common network behind them. So you pick it like an app, and you decide what you like it to look like. You decide, you know, where you want your information to sit, whether you want it to sit on your ISP or whether you want to keep your personal information right on your computer or whether there's some other more innovative way of doing this. But the idea is just to break up the idea that all of this sits with one company. And that's not that hard to do.
How far away do you think we are from this, and how will we find it?
Technically, we could be there tomorrow. In terms of working out the business model and building the ecosystem, it'll take a little bit more than that. And getting people on board, you know, we see adoption rates that are kind of silly crazy on the net with people changing resources quickly. just to look at MySpace. Look how MySpace completely dominated the domain for a short period of time, and now it's pretty much gone.
Yeah, what's MySpace?
Yeah, right, exactly. So there's such fast cycles that I'm not worried about that part of it. In terms of the marketing, there's a great grassroots marketing that just happens on the net. And it wouldn't take much. And given the bad vibes, shall we say, that Facebook puts out between the changes of design that alienate people, the bad user interface, the spying, which people are getting to become aware of, not fully aware of, I don't think it would take much for people to want to move to something else.
That was Jason Ben-Levy, author of Too Much Magic, speaking with KALW's Ben Trefney. And we want to hear from you. How much do you depend on the digital world? Post on our Facebook page, we're KALW News. However, if you're one who's a bit wary of technology, then send us a letter. Our address is 500 Mansell Street, San Francisco, California, 94134. We might just read it on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. While digital connections can feel like they bring us closer, sometimes there's nothing like the warmth and tenderness of live human interaction. And that brings us to your stories. This is San Francisco StoryCorps. About 16 years ago, San Francisco native Alan Manalo visited Manila, the capital of the Philippines, in an effort to reconnect with his heritage. There, he met his wife, Joyce D. Juan Manalo, and recognized that even though they grew up with an ocean between them, they were strikingly similar in many ways. Here, they recall the sparks that connected them in the beginning.
And I started meeting people who were involved in theater in Manila. You know, I remember all you theater folks were hanging out there, and I remember seeing you.
Uh-huh.
you had your hair over one eye, and you were so mysterious looking. And and Melvin had asked me, do you see anybody you're interested in? I said, yeah, who's that girl over there? And go, oh my gosh, that's Joyce. You got to meet her. And I remember when we were finally introduced, you had no interest in me. You kind of shrugged me off. The Lonely Hearts Club party. It was nearing Valentine. And that was the first time you didn't blow me off. we went out for a week. I remember extending my ticket so that we can spend more time. And it was just, Cupid's arrow was all over my body because that was the most beautiful week for me. We had such a great time. And talking to your mom, she goes, you want some coffee? And I said, oh, no, I'm okay. And she said, yeah, Joyce keeps her beans in the freezer. And I thought, that blew me away because, in San Francisco, I had beans in my freezer. And I was thinking, wow, this is crazy. I mean, I'm meeting this woman in the Philippines, and she has coffee beans in her freezer. Your mom goes, yeah, Joyce has a dream of opening up her own coffee house. And that had been my dream since I moved to San Francisco. Burnt scar on burn mark underneath your near your elbow,
right.
And I had it on the opposite side. I had also a burn mark there too, and I was like, oh, there's a connection there. So I remember I just could not stop thinking about you, and finally I had you fly down here.
We got engaged as soon as I
got
landed
to San Francisco. Yeah,
in San Francisco.
Right after I had to drop off my taxes.
Right.
We got married in Vegas, and then 2 months later.
We were on the road.
I took you on the road. That was our first honeymoon, mm-hmm. was to travel across 43 states to do the Blizzard of Bucks show. And
those flea bag motels that
oh,
we
yes,
go to.
Yes, the It'll Do Inn in Texas. I remember you would get mad and you'd go, okay, well, fine, I'll go to the back of the van then. we're about 16 years of marriage for you and I. I think everybody who get married should go on the road for the first year because you learn so much about each other.
That was Alan Manalo and his wife Joyce. Their interview was facilitated by Frank Kingman and produced for KALW by Lisa Ratner. You can find more information about StoryCorps and hear all of our stories at our website, that's KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. If you're walking around a lot outside these days, you may be noticing all the flowers and all the pollen and how allergic you might be feeling as a result. Through the centuries, people have taken honey as a treatment for a variety of ailments, including as an allergy suppressant. But can something that tastes that good really be a medicine? In this piece from our archives, KALW's Stephen Short buzzed around for a few days trying to find the answer.
Here's a riddle. If April showers bring May flowers, what do May flowers bring? Well, if you're in elementary school, you might say May flowers bring pilgrims. And if you're one of the 60 million Americans suffering from allergies, then you know that May flowers also bring headaches, itchy eyes, and scratchy throats.
I moved here about 12 years ago from Austin, Texas, where my allergies bothered me a lot.
That's Patrick Love at a recent farmer's market in San Francisco. While some people take over-the-counter products to combat allergies, Love is among those who swear by a long-standing home remedy, plain old-fashioned, unprocessed, locally produced honey.
I started eating a lot of honey, local honey here. My allergies haven't bothered me since being here in San Francisco. They've improved 100% for me.
You just eat a teaspoon of honey every day in the morning, or whenever you can remember to take it, yeah.
Jamie Collins, a farmer from Carmel, says she uses honey to treat her seasonal allergies as well. She explains the theory behind how it works.
The bees forage in the local weeds and the local plants and the native plants, and if those are the things that you have allergies to and you eat that, you immunize yourself to it.
It does sound logical, but what do the experts say?
There are people who, and I know many, who claim that it has relieved their allergies.
That's Paul Kosky. As a former high school science teacher, he knows that there are no studies to verify the medicinal qualities of local honey. But as a current officer of the San Francisco Beekeepers Association,
and that puts me in the middle, and that's where I am in terms of pollen and allergies and local honey.
Kosky may be on the fence about honey and allergies, but Dr. Natalia Kushner should have a precise answer. She has an allergy and immunology practice in Berkeley and Walnut Creek. She was educated in Russia, where honey is widely used as a folk remedy. And she has also worked at the National Institutes of Health in Washington, D.C., the primary federal agency for conducting and supporting medical research. Her prescription?
By all means, I would never use the honey as a first approach to the patient treatment. I think it would be silly knowing what we know about allergy treatment, because most of the people buy it at the store just to eat it, to put it in the tea, to put it on the pancakes, right?
I've seen everything work and I've seen everything not work. And honey is one of those things that in a few people it works.
Corey Weinstein is a homeopathic physician in San Francisco. He has witnessed the benefits of honey in treating allergies. Sometimes.
It's really all by testimonial. It's by the individual who says, oh, I saw it work in my practice, and therefore it's got to be true. But people tend to forget all the times it didn't work.
If both doctors agree that benefits abound, why then has honey never been scientifically researched as an allergy treatment?
I think it should be done, definitely, because there is an anecdotal evidence that it helps tremendously to some patients.
Well, I think that that's an interesting question, because that goes to the very heart of how decisions are made on what therapeutics are used. It has to do with who will benefit, and I don't think that the big pharmaceutical companies are all that interested in developing honey because it's available to everyone.
And that's especially true of those with access to their own honey, like beekeeper Paul Kosky. He uses honey for his allergies, but still says,
I don't know. You know, I'd have to do my own double-blind study, and I don't have the time to do that, and it doesn't pay to do it. So I'll just continue eating my honey.
Which, as Dr. Kushner says, brings us to the universally prescribed use of honey that has gained the most approval in various trials over the centuries.
Well, definitely it is usually addressed as a food.
It's been said that hope is the only bee that makes honey without flowers. Those with allergies can only hope that honey, or something, will help them survive until those spring flowers wilt. Sail in San Francisco, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
Sail on, my little honeybee, sail on.
What's your go-to medicine? Share your tips with us on our Facebook page. We're KALW News. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Emily Gaddick, Nina Gensler-Debs, Carolina Hidalgo, Chris Hoff, RTM's Konohovs, Casey Miner, Erica Moo, Nina Nicole, Rena Palta, Mary Reese, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, they provide an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. The sounds you're hearing are by the Oakland electro-pop band Mwahaha. No, they're really called Mwahaha. They've been touring the West from Idaho to Arizona, and they're touching down in the Bay Area next Saturday at the Bottom of the Hill in San Francisco. Music starts at 9:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.